Ooh.
Hello and welcome to the Weird Things Podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Brian Brushwood.
Oh my goodness, just a producer extraordinaire.
I know. Well, you're a man of many talents, Brian. Doesn't matter how thinly they're spread, there are many talents.
There's something there.
You know, what else is something? We have Justin Robert Young back in the studio.
Hey, I'm back. I'm back and better than ever.
So I heard that you got our special birthday wish campaign trail message.
I did get a very, very special birthday wish from the one and only depressed Oompa Loompa of the Willy's chocolate experience. It was quite amazing. We played it at the beginning. I got it right before we recorded We're Not Wrong last week. So the episode last week of We're Not Wrong is where you want to go to see the full clip. But it was amazing. It was truly an experience, and it was a very, very heartening moment that for that class of person who finds themselves amidst internet celebrity, this felt like the cleanest way that they could make money. And the good news for that young woman of doing an absolutely horrifyingly shoddily produced production is that it doesn't take much to make a real, super realistic set that looks exactly like the shoddy production that you were a part of. It looked amazing. It looked like
she shot in a meat freezer. So I was not going to lie, sitting on the John, and I see this article about, you know, the Oompa Loompas on Cameo, and I could not fast enough on my phone type in to order you your birthday wish on there. I was like, not even wait to get on my computer. I'm like, I gotta do this. I gotta get this for Justin. So turnaround time was really fast. She was great. Very, very happy about that.
Yeah. Her commitment to character, 10 out of 10. Her Scottish brogue, 11 out of 10. It's just amazing. She is a Glasgow native, man.
Yeah, that's the thing you're not ready for.
From what I'm hearing, it sounds like you got a cameo from one of the characters of
Willy's Chocolate Experience.
The terrible abomination that was overhyped and bad.
Yeah, I mean, overhyped is a weird way to say it, because it's certainly true that it was overhyped, but it wasn't particularly, like, hyped. It wasn't like there were people jumping up and down and screaming, you gotta go to this thing. It was just sort of a regular old kids experience, and boy, did it so under-deliver that overhyped still matters.
So we hear comical sound effects off screen.
Not gonna lie, had a little spider duty here. I got you. Not gonna sit here, not for you all. Let them just sit there and stare at me while I'm doing the show. I'm sorry. This is for fans only. Arachnids not allowed.
Get out of here, you eight-legged freaks.
So what was the cameo?
It was on the same set. I mean, I guess, Andrew, do you have it handy or should I try to find it?
Brian. Second.
All right. Brian. So I'll fill it in. But for folks who are only going to listen to this, imagine the exact picture that you first saw, the depressed Oompa Loompa. And by the way, having heard interviews with this woman, I think it is very, very important to her that she is the depressed Oompa Loompa, not the meth Oompa Loompa, not the Breaking Bad Oompa Loompa.
She's already branding. She's already nailing.
No. The interview that I read of her was like, it was really funny. A lot. Me and my friends are laughing about it. Everybody should find it funny. Less thrilled that people were calling me a meth head. Like, that's not the nicest thing in the world. So depressed Oompa Loompa is the proper nomenclature.
Yeah, and I've seen her, and her name's Kirsty Patterson. I've seen her in interviews. She's a beautiful young woman, and seems very, you know, charismatic, very engaging. So I get that, you know, because that photo of like had to be taken, the photo of the meth Oompa Loompa, stressed middle of the day, any situation. Like I think about the number of times I've had like set photos taken of me where I'm like behind the scenes and I just literally look like a pale ape, you know, just lumbering in the corner. So, hats off to her. So I sent Brian the clip there if you want to take a look. But so those of you who don't know, Cameo is this service where you can get celebrities to send like birthday wishes, you know, motivational things, whatever. And it's really kind of a neat thing because, you know, for, you know, pricing variable from $25 maybe to a couple $100, but to have somebody that you like or whatever and say something cool, a special message is really neat. You know, part about a celebrity, our fascination with it is we want their attention. And this is a really easy way for them to say, okay, I'll give you attention or direct it to where you want within these terms.
All right, here we go. This is the Cameo video.
Hello, Justin. It's your favorite Oompa Loompa here. Good luck in your political journey and your podcast from your favorite Willy Wonka depressed Oompa Loompa.
So very, very deliberate on the word depressed.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. No, she is the depressed Oompa Loompa, and she's my favorite Oompa Loompa. All the rest of them in the movie and the new movie, all of them sit down. Sorry, buddy. You are getting up behind the depressed Oompa Loompa because none of you guys have wished me a happy birthday, and she has. So number one Oompa Loompa in my heart.
Yeah. And good on her and some of the other ones. So that there is a couple of the characters that were from that. There's another Oompa Loompa there, which was, I forget the other. If you go to Cameo, you can see because there's another girl who played an Oompa Loompa. And then for a brief time, a character that was created apparently from this AI generated script, which when you hear the parts of the script, you go, yeah, that feels like ChatGPT-3. They talked about the unknown, and the unknown was somebody wearing a mirror mask and a black robe that would just jump out from behind the little kids from behind a mirror, which actually sounds kind of awesome.
Yeah. This was original IP. This was not from the Roald Dahl Willy Wonka lore. Like the Oompa Loompa. This was a straight OG original.
Where should I search for this?
Did you search?
Well, the unknown popped up on Cameo, then they're gone. Apparently, the unknown was a 16-year-old girl that had to work all day because they didn't have another unknown costume.
Oh no!
That's
so funny. The unknown. You can probably just Google.
I just. Did the unknown and there's an article saying bizarre Willy Wonka mirror character explained. And so it's just a 16-year-old girl running around with a mirror.
With a mirror, a mask, and a Gene Simmons wig.
That's her hair.
Oh, that's her real hair.
Yeah.
What is that? It's the unknown.
And you know, like 5 months we're gonna get the Netflix doc. There's already a musical that somebody's put on about this. It's just the, you know, the people with the Willy Wonka IP and they just did the movie are looking at this going like, what did we do wrong?
Exactly.
That's amazing.
So exciting news. Absolutely congrats to Elon Musk and the team at SpaceX because guess what? Starship yesterday
went up,
took off, made it into separation phase, and it wasn't supposed to go into orbit. So it did a suborbital, but they reached orbital velocities and did a successful launch and separation and reached space. They actually reached the largest object to be ever put by humans into space.
So they straight up passed the Kármán line, the whole nine yards?
Yep. Yep.
Wait, did you say orbit?
No, suborbital.
Suborbit. Okay.
But they reached orbital speeds.
Yeah.
Here's the part I always worry about. Did it land?
No, was not really this mission profile. The profile was really to see if they could try to decelerate into the ocean. And I think the booster came back, and I think the booster they're just trying to do ditches into the ocean for both. They may have been trying as a stretch goal to see if they could relight and get that to happen, but this was purely, can we get the thing into space? They got it in space.
I mean, that's pretty big. Last time I checked, they made entire movies about that capability.
Yeah, and they put Starlink dishes on there and star transmitters, so they were able to basically communicate and send video from all the way up. So if you go to, there's some, you know, they don't put their video on, maybe they put some of this video on YouTube, but they're trying to promote this other platform, X. Synergy. It is quite an amazing achievement, and so congrats to them. And so it's just very, very, very cool that they did that. So let's see, if we go type in Starship into Google search, we'll see some of the other coverage. So if you're a big fan of space and you want to follow somebody who's obsessively covering it, is Tim Dodd, the Everyday Astronaut. They have literally like a whole house they have rented out. They have their own tracking gear. They basically built, you know, network quality facility for being able to track and watch these launches. And so it's just amazing to see somebody who has been very passionate about something professionally keep growing and growing and growing, to the point that if you want coverage on it, Tim's going to give you better coverage than any of the news orgs.
So this
I think you need to scroll back up, Brian.
These are all out of Texas. This launch.
Brian, I'm pretty sure we passed an important. I'm pretty sure it was back up there.
don't you do that? Well, let me see. We are looking at rockets. Oh no.
For audio listeners, Brian's been served very specific ads. Very sexy ladies.
Brian, how dare
the,
you?
The algorithm knows cookies. Only 10s and above.
Cookies.
Only 10s and above. Also, this is a work computer, so this.
Oh, I'll bet you.
I pro tip. This somebody told me this. I don't know if this is useful or not. Be sure to clear out your Safari like saved bookmarks, because sometimes you go click on a link and accidentally save it when you don't mean to, and you go look in that bookmarks folder and you find, oh my god, look at those bookmarks. So
good to know.
Just saying for anybody out there. A friend told me this.
Starship.
So
amazing achievement. So what does this mean? The goal of Starship, there's several steps ahead they need to do. They need to recover the booster. They need to recover the spacecraft. But they were able to get this thing into space. That is a very, very big deal. So it's going to be an iterative process. And thanks to the SpaceX way of doing things is step by step. The next step is going to be, hey, let's, you know, go ahead and see if we can't, you know, land the booster back onto the pad. Let's see if we can get the Starship back in, because that's, you know, the goal of reusability. But I think that they're very well funded. They're very, very focused on what they want to do. You know, by the time something launches, they already know how to build the improved version, which is one of the things I think that their design methods should really be studied by a lot of people. The idea is they capitalize themselves in such a way. This wasn't initially. I mean, even initially, though, they had a couple Hail Marys. They thought they were going to run out of money, and they were able to get one more rocket and manage to get that into orbit and get their contracts. But it is a smart thing to think about, is this is a thing that's common in many tech businesses. You're going to succeed. Success is partially a formula of how much you get to learn and how many experiments you get to run.
Yeah.
I like to think of it, and maybe this is more of an after things topic, but it's like, it's just clock cycles, it's iteration, it's running through the paces over and over and over again.
Yeah, I think so. But I think it's like, and I would add to that, is having that feedback. If you're not getting data every time you do it, then it's not useful. And that's it sounds like an obvious thing, but because to us, but do you have to think about that? When I knew I wanted to become an author, I said, I need to write 10 books, but I wasn't just going to write 10 books in a row. I'd write a book, then I'd read a book on writing. And then the next book, I would think about that when I wrote my next book. And then I'd write a book and read a book on writing and start to do these postmortems. You start to analyze that. So every time you get those improvements, just doing things out of repetition with no feedback loop for information, you may never make progress. And I think that's a problem with a lot of things, is that we often just repeat the same things over and over again, but we're not really analytical. You know, Peter Thiel says that he thinks that we fetishize failure too much, that we, you know, maybe we should just pay more only attention to why things are successful. And I get what he's trying to mean by that is that, like, when you're trying to learn from these things, everything's going to have a reason for failure. The reasons for success might be fewer than we realize.
Yeah, I think in his world of the VC stuff, I get that, in that some people can be they come back and get two or three different chances because there's a lot of very, very good explanations for failure, and it's like, oh well, you learned a lot, and it's like, well, maybe sometimes,
yeah,
but the success ultimately defines you.
Yeah, so it's really an exciting thing. I think that's funny too, is that yesterday we lobbed the largest rocket ever into space.
Yeah,
I'm like, oh, and it's like, oh, it's cool.
Yeah, you know, and it's funny because that kind of goes to where sort of Elon Musk is now. It's like he did two things that were thought to be impossible, build a space company and build an American car company. He did both, but now they're both just kind of like wallpaper. They're very cool. Our society and our world is better because of it. But, you know, now the most exciting thing about him is, you know, the tweets. it's remarkable. I mean, it's a credit to his success that these things exist, but also that's, you know, see that tweet.
Hey, Elon Musk. Hello, man on the street. We're doing an interview. Elon Musk. Who's he? The tweet guy.
The tweet man. He tweets.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's a complicated legacy.
Well, look, I think it's just the reality that all news fades, and it doesn't matter what the news is. All news becomes old, and we are blessed to live in times where we got a lot of news. Cool things happen all the time.
Yeah, I one of the things I, you know, realized is I have a believe it or not, guys, I'm very opinionated. But outside these microphones and our phone calls and my Twitter and my social media, I'm very careful. Not out of fear, but like I want to be focused about what I talk about.
Yeah.
And that's a thing.
Maybe it's too early to talk about it, but it's like I feel like that with the diaspora of everybody going to, you know, their Blue Skies and their Mastodons and their Threads and all that stuff, it does feel safer around here.
Here being where?
The internet.
Well, how do you mean?
I mean, like, there was a hot minute where it's like every single post felt like a liability, and that wasn't fun.
Are you saying the hall monitors have all moved to different places?
I'm saying that it's not as easy to create a critical nexus that causes a lot of trouble, and that you can, the same thing that grabbed us all attention of being wild and, you know, crazy guys early on became a liability at some point. And it does feel like it's safer nowadays.
I think a thing that happened too was that if somebody said a dumb tweet, and I decided that I was going to go call this person out for their dumb tweet, people are going to be very quick to go scrutinize my tweet history. And I think that we saw some very prominent, people ringing the shame bell from Game of Thrones. All of a sudden, people are like, well, you did this. And it's like, well, that's different because it's me. And I think we saw a bit of that where it was the kind of that we realized that, you know, we all live in glass houses.
Yeah. And I think that, eventually, the canceling Reaper comes for all of us.
Yeah.
And,
oh my God.
And I think we've all had our fill of it.
I had a conversation the other day with some neighbors. They're talking about, you know, some local kids in the high school here that were in the back of the car and made a video where they said inappropriate racial things, joking as kids do. And they're like, oh, why didn't, and it went viral. And they're like, why didn't the father say anything? Why did he do anything that's like this? And I'm like, but there for the grace of God go I, for all this dumb stuff that I have said, taken out of context, that I'm like, I'm not going to yell. I think that, yeah, these kids, this is, you know, I said also, I was trying to make these things aren't real to them. Like, I was trying to explain these adults, like, these things aren't real to them. You know, like, that they never met a person. They're not, they don't normally know somebody who grew up through segregation or understand like that struggle and what went through. So, like, you know, they're given this, it's like kids born post 9/11. Like, man, you all are traumatized about something. And it's like, well, yeah. And for them, it's different. And it's just hard for, I think, a generational thing to understand these things are different to kids.
Yeah. And
cancel them anyways.
More grist for the mill. We sacrifice at dawn.
Hey. I mean, Justin, if you had, I think, you know, how quickly would you have been canceled? Yeah. Well,
why are you doing?
No, yeah, no. I look, there's stuff out there now that doesn't age well, or you know, that people could say, hey, look at this thing that you said on the internet. And it's like, yeah, I was a kid who loved certain comedians and loved talk radio, which at that point was very much through an arc of shock jock. So there's stuff that said, and, you know, I don't know.
Nobody's asking you to defend yourself here.
Well, no, I'm thinking because like of the mechanism of it. The biggest thing that cancel culture kind of came for were very entrenched but top heavy leadership cultures. So academia, media, places where one or two people could make a decision, and then all of a sudden, you know, somebody gets excised or blah 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 blah. You combine that with everybody getting up to speed on what the internet means and what it doesn't mean while everything else in media is collapsing. So the traditional barometers for what people care about are kind of gone. And that leads us to the place that we were then. Yeah. As to the crimes, the sins, they'll always change. Like we went through a particular period of like, oof, didn't age well, but there's nothing to say that in 10 years we won't be like, ah, remember the great classic comedy of these people? We don't know. Culture waxes and wanes, and it depends on a lot of different stuff. Like, the one thing that I think is disingenuous is to insinuate that nothing has ever changed. That, I think, is disingenuous to suggest that, like, no, it's unfair to say, but the rules changed on me. You're right. The rules do change. It's not nice or fair, but that often happens. Just don't gaslight and say like, this is the way it's always been. It's like, no, we live in a weird society.
So I've got good news for you.
What's that?
We might be able to replace this weird society with robots.
Oh, damn.
Them cancelable robots.
Yep.
Listen, like, you don't like your friends replaced with robots. That's what you can do now.
Yeah.
Brian, I sent you a clip, which is a company, Figure AI. Full disclosure, they have a partnership with OpenAI, but I'm no longer at OpenAI. So it's just obviously, bias whatsoever.
But. Loading it up right now, boss. There we go.
So Figure AI is really doing some very cool things with robotics. One of the things they're doing now is they're merging ChatGPT with robots. And basically we're going to watch it perform a really interesting task, and it's going to talk to you. And I want to get your take on this. So it's a shiny chrome steelish looking robot
in the center of the table, a drying rack with cups and a plate, and you standing nearby with your hand on the table.
Great. Can I have something to eat?
Just kills him.
Sure thing.
Wow. So we're seeing extremely precise finger movements.
Can you explain why you did what you just did while you pick up this trash?
Holy moly.
On it. So I gave you the apple because it's the only edible item I could provide you with from the table.
It even does the vocal stammer.
Yeah.
Great. So based on the scene right now, where do you think the dishes in front of you go next?
Oh my God. Oh my God.
The dishes on the table, like that plate and cup, are likely to go into the drying rack next.
Great. Can you put them there?
Of course.
So this is really... Oh my God. Forgive the silence, audio listeners. This is astonishing.
All right, so how do you think you did?
I think I did pretty well. The apple found its new owner, the trash is gone, and the tableware is right where it belongs.
I agree. Thanks, Figure One.
You're welcome. If there's anything else you need help with, just let me know.
Holy moly! When did this release?
This video came out 2 days ago. So what makes this cool is GPT-4 since last year has had vision capabilities. And I've helped a little bit with some people working on machine learning, machine vision tasks and some robotics companies. I have nothing to do with this company. I put out a post, by the way, a couple of days ago, correcting a research paper that said that there was this limitation in visual reasoning. I showed with a little tweak on their prompt, you could improve it like 95%. So what they're doing here is they're using GPT-4 vision, which is GPT-4's vision capability, with their existing robotics hardware and their own software. The idea is the GPT-4V can look at a scene and say, oh yeah, that's an apple, that's trash, that's this, whatever. And then it can figure out, I need to put X over here, do this there. Then their robotic software carries over. And it's this wonderful integration between the reasoning of a GPT-4 level system with the be able to embody something in physical space that can actually carry out a task that has the fine dexterity to do these things. And so I'm not going to name companies, but this may be something owned by somebody who we may have mentioned previously in the show. They did a demo where they showed a robot folding a shirt, which everybody was impressed with. Somebody's pointed out, if you look at the lower corner, you see what looks like somebody's hand with a telemetry glove actually controlling it remotely to do the shirt folding, which is makes me anxious if they're going out of their way to fake demos like that, because that is a fake to me. That is a, I'm not going to show you this thing over there. So we're here, Figure AI, like by all accounts, like you see, they let the pauses in there. They're showing you it's the GPT-4 waiting to respond, you know, as it does a thing. They didn't try to speed it up as far as I can tell. I think this was a very fair demo.
And a trivial thing, but it sounds like there's a different voice on there. But also, like, the all of the movements and the decisions are 100% congruent with my experience with using the voice chat on GPT-4.
Yeah.
So I'd be a liar if I said I wasn't surprised, because I was surprised, but also, after watching this, I understand why this might not be surprising.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's extraordinarily impressive. And I do agree, Andrew, that especially these days, the era of the vaporware demo hopefully is becoming increasingly passe. We are at a moment of show us what you got right now and not show us what you could do in 5 years.
You hear that, Boston Dynamics?
Yeah. So it's a long ways from the demo, the lab floor to the production line, but we've talked about this before. We're going to see a huge acceleration for robotics. There are dozens of companies out there working on cool stuff. This is one of them. I think that we're going to see a revolution, and part of what they did here, which is cool, is marrying the smarts of an LLM like GPT-4 that's multimodal, can do vision, with their own robotics hardware and software. You let GPT-4 do the high level reasoning. Hey, yeah, this is an apple, this is the You know, people point out, hey, it takes time. It's slow. Like, it's true. And what will happen over time is you can start making, you can one, use a bigger model to train a smaller model that's much faster. Two, as the bigger models become more efficient.
And even as we've learned with GPT's coding skills, I mean, like you could code faster and correct faster by having robots do the robots do the robots. That's extraordinary. Have they made any claims about when this would be available or anything?
They have a plan, which you can go look at their website, which I don't think they have any specific date as to when they're, I think they're probably going to be, you know, one of the things you do with robotics is you'll often find company partners and do try things experimentally to put them into different plants and stuff. So they have their master plan, the roadmap, which is talking about their goals of what they're trying to do. And, you know, the long road plan is, you know, you got to read that there are three major business opportunities in the long term as a Vangelis track plays in the background. So go to figure.ai master plan, the slash master plan.
Sure.
And I just need you to show this.
Okay. Figure.ai slash master plan is coming up.
Hyphenate plan. Yeah. Yeah.
Master plan. Okay. Are they going? Oh, nope. Maybe I did some WWWs at the beginning. Maybe that shouldn't have been there. There we go.
Dr. Chiron in the chat says the robot throws away trash and does dishes already more useful than my kids.
Master dash plan. F-I-G-U-R-E. Got it. Master dash plan. Okay.
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah. There we go.
There it is. Yeah. Scroll down and you'll see.
Okay.
There'll be a black box. I want you to see that.
Okay. Let me get this the right size. Three major business opportunities for the long term. We got physical labor. That makes sense. Consumer household. Doing the things you don't want to do, keeping things, you know, let the dogs out, feed them, all that stuff. Oh my God, off world. They are not messing around.
Wait for the Nexus 6 models for that. I think they'll be really capable, right? So, but that is, we're really having trouble grasping right now, what does it mean to have abundant AI? You know, we live in, GPT-4 came out a year ago. Now we have GPT-4, OpenAI, probably not sitting around, but we have Gemini Ultra. We have Claude 3. Claude 3, I think, is a very capable model. And next year, there's going to be even more capable models. We're going to get these things in even more places. And the stuff that you run on devices be incredible. And we're still trying to, what does that mean? I talk to people now who we work at ChatGPT all day long using this. Yeah. When we start talking about robotics, and one of the things, as you know, about robotics is once you get to a certain state with robotics, your labor cost for building robots goes down because your robots can help you build them.
Right.
And that's a very interesting factor because where would you want robots? And we could talk about, you know, what it means for labor economics, but I'm writing an article about this, but like my short thesis is this, is that when you have this kind of increases in efficiency and productivity, the surface of the area of the economy grows so much more faster. You actually have higher employment opportunities than you did before.
Yeah.
What does it mean on a personal level? You know, anybody who has older family members, how would it be nice to, you know, have a robot in the house to help them to take care of stuff?
And that goes for more than just doing menial labor. It also goes for like, hey robot, one of your jobs is to, you know, I'm worried about my life partner. They have these medical conditions. Will you please text me? I would like to be able to leave the house and go to the grocery store without being terrified that I'm going to come back and my life partner is dead. And instead, you know, you get a text saying, I have seen signs of whatever. All of that sounds so ex machina and so terrifying, but also at the end of the day, it's like, yeah, I'll buy one.
So I had this idea because we are just coming out of what at one time was one of our favorite weeks of the year, the quote unquote tech week of South by Southwest. And in a bygone era, that was the place where you would debut new websites, apps, stuff like that. It was very much a town square for a lot of the tech press and VCs. That has kind of faded out. Tech Week has kind of become Media Week. So you have a lot of people promoting new movies and television shows, but you don't see the same kind of buzz or tech stuff. I had this thought today. I wonder if next year that's going to be different. If the good old days are going to be back, because I think 1 year from today, it's we're going to see a lot of the fruits of the post AI, post LLM kind of world. And I wouldn't be shocked if somebody decides to use it, or a lot of people decide to try to say, hey, this is real estate that launched Twitter, helped launch Facebook, helped launch a lot of these different big companies. You can get a lot of different people to think a lot of different cool things if you are the buzz of Sixth Street, you know, for 5 days in March.
Well, and I would imagine that a full on droid walking down Sixth Street, having conversations with people, walking in, ordering drinks, delivering things,
turned some heads.
It would be worldwide news, and there's no reason it can't be done.
Yeah, Daniel J. Newman says that AI was big at CES. Yes, and everything's big at CES because CES is about selling microwaves and televisions. Not to say that CES isn't really important. It is really important, but it's important for a different sector. The audience at CES is not only the press, but really buyers, people that are looking to fill different areas of need for them. It's not consumer, and it's not just about customer acquisition. South by was, oh my God, are you on blank? And 9 times out of 10, it was a thing that you would maybe use for a little bit during the South by event. But
you and I signed up for Twitter back in like 2000.
Exactly. But like sometimes it's Twitter. Sometimes it's like it's really, really, it's Foursquare. It's a lot of these apps that were really, really important. Big apps like Looped, you know? Like whoever,
right. Muskrat, yeah,
whoever would go on after that thundering failure.
Oh, sometimes the real talent rises from the ashes there. So I think there's something to that. There's a term that's being used around the Valley right now, one venture capitalist, which is American dynamism, which is the idea of investing in American companies that are, you know, building things based on core strengths, technology, et cetera, what have you. And there's a number of companies now that are newer companies as we watch, you know, a Boeing wither in the wind and slowly deteriorate in reputation, et cetera. You know, you have, you know, Andrew Palmer Luckey's defense technology company, which came in and has been disruptive because they're building technology that seems to be more effective, more cost effective than the traditional defense partners. They got criticized because Andrew's slogan is fight unfair. And they're building like stealth jets and other stuff like this, kind of like really cool tech. And then there's other companies like that. And I think a lot of these robotics companies, which are US based, and there is this interest of the idea of like, can robotics and stuff lead you to building up a manufacturing might? You know, it's very, so yeah, I think to your point about South by, I think that could be a thing where we might start to see a lot of this stuff showcased because some of these things we want to see in person. But I will say we are in this phase now of there is, having followed as you have technology for years.
Yeah.
We are in a miracle per week phase now. And yes. I would say that last week, the thing that caught everybody's attention was, or earlier, maybe earlier in the week, was Devin which is a new coding tool, which is basically runs like you just tell it, build this application, and it's agent based, goes online, finds the things it needs to do, goes and builds the code, runs tests on it, corrects it, fix it, and then finishes with a, in theory, finished code. Now, their examples to me are like, well, there's the problem is these are toy apps. They like build a game of life website, which I'm like, man, that was one of the first demos I did with GPT, with the code capability for GPT-4 was game of life as a little thing. This is way more sophisticated, but that company, you know, really caught people by storm because software developers were thinking, well, I could use GPT-4. I use a tool called Cursor, which is a code, basically an environment where I could actually do a demo if you wanted to see this, but it's pretty cool because basically I have my development environment for writing code, and I have my sidebar where I can chat with ChatGPT, and I can then say, hey, write a server app that does blankety blank, and it says, okay, here's what I do, and I click okay, run, and it starts to write the code into the other window, and I can run it, and I can say change this, and it will go back line by line and find the spot to change it. So that's a tool called Cursor, which took the Copilot idea that Microsoft had and went even further. And we're only a year into this, folks.
Yeah, I think to me, you're right. Miracle a week is probably a good way to put it. We are in a development cycle that is similar to the early internet, but sped up. Like the capabilities, the speed and the money and the talent and the pool of people that want to push this forward are all so much larger. Not to mention that the fundamental change, the tech that is actually going to shift everything is quick and getting quicker. The question is exactly how much it costs to do, who's subsidizing it, and how that will continue to become more efficient.
So this week was the 1 year anniversary of the release of GPT-4, right?
Yeah.
And one of my friends still at OpenAI texted me and said that like it feels like 3 years ago. And I'm like, yeah, like OpenAI time is very different from other time. Like when I started there, like 2020 feels like 10 years ago to me because just the release cycle. So the Sora, the video generator, how long ago was that announced?
Sora, I would hazard to say somewhere between 6 months. No, I mean, I think probably about 5 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago.
Yep. 4 weeks ago, four weeks ago. So, but it's the subject of like, it feels like we know about this thing for months now because the talk about it. And then I get I've had some days with, you know, back-to-back calls like 1 hour later trying to explain, you know, industry implications for generative AI, you know, then doing late night calls. Like I had one call that literally I got noticed 30 minutes before. Can you do a consultation call? Because these people really want to know what to do. And you're watching that impact that these things happen. So like I said, it is a miracle a week phase right now. And
yeah, I think in terms of people who are following the bleeding edge of it, there's no doubt that this is going really, really fast. The question is exactly what is the life cycle in terms of it breaking into the mainstream, and what does that mean? You know, what is the floor for what we would consider to be a successful AI powered application? Like, is it that it makes money? Is it that it could, you know, exponentially explode and become something far bigger? Like, what's the gold standard prize, right? Like back in the day, in the early days of the internet, we had understandings of like, okay, if Google is on Good Morning America, it matters, right? If getting a book delivered to your house is on 2020 or 60 minutes, it matters. What is that now? Like, I don't even know what it is.
I mean, to use Silicon Valley speak, like, what is the killer app for AI? And now, of course, AI is many things, but what is the thing that everybody could instantly understand? I need that. Let's go.
Well, it's interesting, too, because like when the conversation, the topic that comes up repeatedly when I speak to VCs now is they're trying to figure out what will be a business 5 years from now, because they look at how quickly AI can replace stuff and things all of a sudden become just features.
Yeah.
Because that's part of it, is the idea is that they go like, yeah, this is cool, hey, we got this company here that's built their generative AI thing. Is OpenAI going to come out with something that's just going to blow it out of the water, you know, whatever. I'm like, well, and like, I'm the generative AI space. The advice I give is like, OpenAI showed Sora. Google has amazing people working on video generation. They've all of a sudden been the reason Sora did the reason Sora is as good as it is partially has to do with one that's compute, but it's basically they used a different approach, which is breaking up each frame into separate space time regions, et cetera. But there's a new approach out there that shows really good results. Meta wants to do video. So you're just going to see these things where for smaller companies, people trying to get in there, like you, I've had people asking me like, you know, what is the consumer space for generative AI? And I'm like, I'm like, I don't know. Like there's everybody's going to be building these tools into what they do. And man, it's hard. Like I just move so fast.
I mentioned this before, but I just have this core, feeling that, and we don't have to talk about this if that's not what you're into, but it's like we're all about to become either pioneers or poets. Either you're going to stay on Earth and you better be a poet and you better tell better stories that to earn your place here in this petri dish, or you could go out and do labor and expand off the planet. In my mind, it was always a 100-year task, a 100-year phenomenon. But Andrew, Justin, it feels closer than ever to me right now. I mean, what, maybe 20 years?
Timelines are really, really hard because I'll give you a hypothetical. I was talking to somebody the other day about a company that was built a product that's really good for the legal industry. It's a really useful product that can revolutionize the legal industry. The problem they're having is nobody there wants to use it, because they have all their fears, some unfounded, some realistic, whatever, and it could radically improve that industry, but the adoption rate is really slow. Sam Altman's made the point that we're likely to achieve AGI or ASI on a much sooner timeline than anybody had really thought, but the implementation, the point at which it starts to affect the world around us, is going to take longer. So I think that, you know, I think that we're going to be, you know, dropping 1,000-figure AI robots on Mars before we try to build a bigger human habitat. You know, we'll put some people on there, have them go in there, do a touchdown, whatever. But then I think we're going to leave the robots there to do the long-term building and stuff. I think you want to, but when is that time? Is that 20 years? Maybe. I mean, there's, I don't see a technical limitation to that happening. You know, we just had Starship work. We had that. I mean, Elon not wanting Figure A on there because it competes with the Tesla Optimus robot. That's a possibility. Who knows? But
well, I mean, let's understand what 20 years is. 20 years ago today, we were talking about John Kerry's Swift boat. Like that seems like a very long time ago.
That was also 5 years before we almost destroyed our friendship arguing about space elevators and reusable rockets. That's how far along ago that is.
So it's like,
was it destroy our friendship, Brian? Because we would still want to go, who can I argue with about space elevators with?
Oh, no. Yeah, or you know what? I say destroy, but maybe what I mean is finally bonded.
Yeah. Exactly. Forged the respect through combat.
Yes, exactly.
But that brings up we'll bring this one up again. But the point, because that the contention kind of came from was, yeah, you know, my position was, I don't think there's technically a problem with this thing working. I just don't. I think the number of people that have to buy into it for it to happen just will never happen. And that's one of the things you have to think about adoption, is to say that we can have this amazing thing, but you have to get a lot of people to buy in, and a lot of people who are often justifiably hesitant because you don't want, well, so-and-so said it works, so we're all going to do it. I think that's a big factor. But yeah, I think that we are the three pillars that I think that we need. We'll put one is ASI, artificial superintelligence. That is we're on a glide path towards where I think we keep doing what we're going to be doing. We're going to get to there. Okay. robotics. I think the idea of getting robots that are human level dexterous, and you've seen the thing like Boston Dynamics does, et cetera. The problem they have is they seem to be really good at building these machines one off, not so good at figuring out how to manufacture them at low cost, but that's going to take some bottlenecks to break through. But I think that like human dexterous level robotics, which seems possible. The third thing is energy, is cheap energy production, which is fusion. Said this before, I'm very optimistic that we're going to have commercially viable fusion by the end of this decade. And you know, the adage goes, well, it's always been 20 years away. Like, yeah, it was a government project for the last, 60, 70 years. Those are the only people investing, more than a few million dollars into fusion was the government. And it was only the DOE, which was dedicated towards building a tokamak reactor design, which the original designers knew 40 years ago that would not be a commercially viable thing towards fusion. It's a good thing to experiment with. So I'm very bullish we'll have it. But does that mean if all of a sudden, next year Helion, whatever, flips on their new reactor, their fusion reactor, and it's energy positive and whatever, that everything, our energy grid problems are solved? No, because you have to build millions of these things. You have to get them out there into the grid and the world and finance them and have the electrical power support that can support that. And that's hard. But that's the kind of thing where if you have robots, it's easier.
So I know we're about to have to move into picks, but it's like, I think to myself, a lot of people are afraid of AI replacing them. Most of them are really just afraid of having to be in charge of other things, right? So let's say everybody gets a UBI happens, and let's say every human, like at this point, all energy concerns, all everything's concerns are handled by robots and for sake of argument, let's say solar power or fusion or what have you. I can truly picture a world where it's like every human is assigned a few robots, and it's up to you to decide what kind of clever things you want your robots to do that will benefit not the other robots, but other humans, because at the end of the line, all we want to do is please each other and make everybody else happier. I don't know. Maybe that's too Pollyanna.
I think the challenge is that, we're burdened by what's came before us and what we know about now. And it's hard for, I think that at that point, we're going to be kind of post-robotics, which I could go into a whole nother show what I mean by that.
That's where we get into nano land. And
how much of the material in the world is scaffolding that we don't really, there's a whole nother discussion about that. But that is a concern though. Whenever I post something about AI, whatever, on my Twitter feed, I get people respond who are like, now that the anti-robot people are coming forward. It was funny in science fiction. We were like, who'd be opposing robots? Well, those people have emerged now, and they're anti this. And it's just, on one hand, it's easy to sort of like, cool, but you're cool with electricity. Should we get rid of that? But there are people genuinely afraid because one is that they see, AI generative art is being displacing to artists, although the really talented artists I know are doing exceptionally well and really know how to use it. But that doesn't mean the fear is not real. I think that people are looking at the idea of, Justin and I were talking about this, is that when they start putting robots in supermarkets to restock shelves, people are going to lose their heads because that's going to be frustrating. Because every time they see a robot out in real space doing a job a human did, they're going to assume there's some human somewhere that did not get that job, which may be true. And it's hard for people to understand, when people are like, we should, Bernie Sanders is like, we should only work 32 hours a week and minimum wage should be $50 an hour. Those are great ideas. What is the economic reality of that? Like, do you think fast food is too expensive now? Do you think this is? But also, it's not the answer is to say, keep people poor and don't, make them overwork. But these are complex things. It's hard to sort of unpack them when people only look at it from one thing or their worldview is limited. That being said, where do we go? What does the future look like? And I could see a world where The beautiful thing about robotics is, having lived in and traveled through developing countries where people can't afford proper housing because their economic output doesn't justify the economic output that it takes to build a house or to do this thing on a pure one-to-one ratio. When you lower the cost of that by robotics, it means, man, a lot more housing for people, way more housing for people. You know, when you think about these areas that are late, you go like, well, how can they be labor scarce for so many people? Well, if I sell oranges on the street, there's not enough, I can't sell enough oranges to pay for the number of people it takes to build a car. You know what I'm saying? And like with robotics, that changes and those economics get way more interesting. So we can unpack that, I guess, at some other time.
Yeah, I feel like we have like 5 to 7 more episodes to walk through.
I got a feeling that this will continue to be at the top of our mind in future weeks. In the meantime, with the blessing of patreon.com/weirdthings, where you can support this show. Well, you got any picks, Mr. Brushwood?
I don't know if I've talked about it on this show, but I mentioned it on Cord Killers. I got my wife and daughter to watch Dino De Laurentiis's Flash Gordon. And I did it for one reason. It was so like she was a little bit down, and I'm like, whoa, what are you doing, girl? You gotta summon some better energy. You know what you need? You need to be a little bit Brian Blessed. And she's like, I don't know what that means. And I was like, big old bushy beard, giant mouth that opens like a truckosaurus and just says, well, nobody lives forever. Dive. And so I got my wife and my daughter to watch Flash Gordon. And oh boy, it is exactly what it is. But it was a lot of fun to go back and revisit like that kind of unbridled joy. If it wasn't last week's picks, it's this week's pick. Flash Gordon.
Has there been like a good doc about the Dino De Laurentiis era?
I don't think there has been. The most adjacent one would have been Jodorowsky's Dune or whatever, but like from what I understand, there's so many weird things about the Flash Gordon movie and Dune, right? So Dune, David Lynch directed and hated so much that he refused to let his name be attached to it. So he did the Alan Smithy thing, which is a way to not have your name associated with the thing. Dino De Laurentiis also did Conan. He also did Flash Gordon. What's that?
King Kong.
King Kong.
Oh, and King Kong. Oh, that's right, where he goes to the Twin Towers. he also, but also during that time, during Flash Gordon, from what I've read, everybody working on set was like, well, this is fun. This is a camp movie. We're just going to go over the top and have fun. Apparently, Dino De Laurentiis was the only one who didn't know he was making a camp movie where everyone was just going to have a lot of fun. Also, Flash Gordon's voice, he couldn't make it for the ADR session. And so none of that is the actual actor's voice.
Yeah. There is some amazing stuff that kind of came out of there. And like, I think that like Conan, which I think Conan is like one of the greatest fantasy movies of all time. And that was John Milius. You know the story about John Milius and Big Lebowski?
No.
Oh yeah. That's the
John Goodman's character.
Yeah. The footprint of John Goodman's character is John Milius.
Yeah. So, Milius is a fascinating guy, but yeah, like there is, we think there's a lot of the super, super cheesy sort of over the top movies that De Laurentiis did. And then there's some, you know, kind of really incredible ones too. Like sometimes just things got through that, like Serpico. Right. I loved like Conan's one of my, I think is amazing. I loved, King Kong. I liked the version that they did, the 1976 King Kong version. My favorite thing about that too was, I don't know if you remember, but De Laurentiis really understood publicity PR. He really, really had a great grip on that. When they made King Kong, there was footage where they showed this giant mechanical robot, this giant King Kong, which was like half ape suit, like half ape, and then like they had an arm expansion or whatever that was shown, like was open. And they had said they built a giant, fully articulated robotic ape to play the part of King Kong. Now, in reality, that thing they built was in for like 3 seconds of the film, where just the arm raised. You can clearly tell it's basically a building with a gorilla suit put on it. But as a kid, I'm like, oh my God, they can build giant apes now. And that was, that made the press. It's PR. And sometimes you'll see stuff like that. I forgot there was something more recent where, you know, they get a lot of attention. They did that in Jurassic Park. We're like, oh, it's all CG. It's all CG. The original Jurassic Park,
16 minutes. CG.
What's that?
I think it was 16 minutes in the entire movie had CG in it.
And the rest was puppets, that Stan Winston puppets. And you know, you walk away going, man, that looked realistic. Like that was a puppet. And so.
I was working at the movie theater as a projectionist, and I know I've told this story, but there is an assistant manager who just said the most wonderful thing that makes my heart happy to this very day. He was like, man, I watched that Jurassic Park and those dinosaurs, they look so real, but I know they can't be real because they didn't have no cameras back then.
It's amazing.
Fair point.
When you're right, you're right.
My pick is Cursor, which is a development platform for, it's an IDE. It's built on top of the VS Code platform, whatever the open source version of that is. Long story short, if you want to write code, you want to do cool stuff, I think Cursor is pretty good. They have a really generous trial period. All my friends use it. I'm like, man, I'm good using GPT-4 and copy-pasting and doing that. And then I open up Cursor, like, I don't want to learn it. And then I'm doing a lot of copy-paste. I'm like, let me try this. And I used it. I'm like, oh my God, I'm so stupid. Like, I ignore this for months because I'm an idiot. So I think I told Sam that, you know, I don't care. Like, I'm still using G4. It's not really for me. And he's like, this heck, you idiot.
My pick is Dark Dive, the latest Sloan McPherson book by Andrew Main. Available on Amazon. Mm.
Sounds
intriguing.
How's it doing, Andrew?
So, Brian, what if it was like a critical failure right now? And like, I was like, about to get canceled for it.
I would say, Andrew, I'm so glad that I'm your friend now and will always be your friend. Unless it was like really gross.
I subscribe to Blinkist, where they do these things like short versions of books because I have a short attention span. And there was one about cannibalism. And I'm like, you know, the taboo against cannibalism may not always be in place because, you know, climate change and
stuff. Oh, Jesus.
And I'm like, what? You know, and then, you know, the next day, Haiti. You know?
I was going to say, is that self-published by General Barbecue?
Yeah, I was just, but it was just, there was this funny thing about like, oh, like this taboo, they're like one of the only remaining taboos. I'm like, no, I can think of a couple other taboos that are pretty taboo. But it was just this like it was a very academic, like, who are we to judge? I'm like, I don't know. People who don't want to get eaten. Back to Dark Dive, which has part of the storyline does take place with something that happened about 10,000 years ago, which I could have involved cannibals if I wanted, but it does not. So yeah, Dark Dive is the fifth book in the Underwater Investigation Unit series featuring Sloan McPherson. Right now 45 in the Kindle store. It's doing 4.5 stars out of 5, 259 ratings, a 4.4 on Goodreads, which is actually really good. Very happy with the book, but very happy with the next journey. And the story involves Sloan McPherson, our protagonist, a friend of her family, is somebody who she learned a lot of diving skills from, who is a cave diver, has gone missing. and they think he's gone missing in a cave, but there's some suspicious circumstances around that. So she has to go out and try to find out what's going on, and found that he fell in with a group, a bunch of dive rats who like to do cave dives, and there's a big mystery unfolding there.
So. Get it? Get it on Amazon.com.
Yeah, and I like that. I like to read reviews that have really nice sayings by people I've never met. So
there we go. Read it. If you like it, make sure you review it. I mean, so much of Andrew's writing career started right here on this podcast, where good-hearted humans like yourself understood that concept of exactly how much a good review matters on those platforms. So please, please, please support the good Mr. Maine.
Yes. Thank you. Gentlemen, it's been weird.